Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison and to our program today by Kathy Converse and Christina Clark talking about the conference they went to last month in Fitchburg, the 7th Annual Bioethics Forum. And was it Evolution in the 21st?
Yes, evolution in the 21st century.
Yep.
I didn't make copies for everybody in... Not one, but each table, I did make a copy of the brochure, which you can just look at in general. Obviously, in looking at the factor of time, we're not going to cover a lot of it, so I thought you might want to look at it. This is considered an international bioethics forum. It was held April 17th and 18th at the Promega Corporation here in Madison. And this is the seventh year, and the overall goal of these forums is to provide the public, that's an important thing, is the public with access to, they say, accurate scientific information and discussion of related social and ethical issues. It was interesting for me as a scientist to look at the presentations because the presentations were definitely geared toward people who may or may not have any specific background in the topic. And they also were trying to deal with a lot of the issues which are somewhat controversial. And there certainly were people within the group who held some fairly conservative, and there were also a faith-based community there. There were quite a few people who I believe were ministers are directly associated with other churches. So I think the potential was there for some really, what I was hoping for was going to be some really, not heated, but some really strong debate and people really giving opinions. That didn't happen, but I'll talk a little bit more about that. So the overview was, they were looking at evolution and creationism, and that was definitely by far the big main factor that I think almost every talk addressed in some way. And then looking at both the historical context, how these ideas and thoughts progressed, and then kind of what is the current thinking of the main people doing research and people publishing on those topics. And they talked about diverse faith perspectives, and this certainly was dealt with within some of the breakout groups, but I didn't really feel that the diverse faith aspects were particularly dealt with by any of the invited speakers. with the hope that they were to reconcile evolution and religion. And the final factor was the complexities of biopolitics and as far as where are we currently headed with this whole the whole feature of basic rights, certainly from the perspective of us as individuals, but again, a lot of emphasis on schools and education relative to the aspects of creationism. the sponsors, they had lots of sponsors, and you can certainly check out that list, but they were everywhere from like hospice care all the way through to different businesses and agencies as well as scientific groups. The way it was set up was that they would, they started out with some speakers, and Christina will tell you in a few minutes about two of the opening speakers, and then we broke up into discussion groups, came back together for a speaker, broke up again in discussion groups, had lunch, and then the afternoon continued in the same way. So with the exception of one of the groups, we tried to go to different groups each time to get a little better perspective, but within each group there were three different sessions. So there were 12 sessions and 2 days and two people, so we can only tell you about some of them. And they are summarized. They're on one of the sheets. It does say a little summary of what each of the sessions were. And you could ask us if there's one you're particularly interested in, a speaker or a session. I'll speak for Christine. Christine's a wonderful note taker. I don't take as many notes. Mine are a little less, but we will try to give you some specifics if it's not something that we cover. Within the speakers, they had biologists, paleontologists, historians, as well as people who were more directly involved with theology and looking at policy, and then folks such as Eugenie Scott, who was very involved in education. And I will read the statement that they had here, because kind of overall is the direction they came from. Evolution, the process of change over time and the heritable characteristics or traits of a population of organisms, is a bedrock theory of modern biology. In recent years, it has become socially controversial as proponents of creationism and intelligent design have argued that the theory does not adequately explain the complexity of life. Efforts to integrate alternative theories of life into school curricula have generated much public debate and legal wrangling. At the forum, talks will cover topics such as evidence for evolution, the history of anti-evolutionism, evolution in faith, and evolution in the classroom. And the speakers that they particularly highlighted when they were talking about the conference was Eugenie Scott, who's the executive director of the National Center for Science Education. And Eugenie did meet, was that one, 2 weeks ago, at, we had dinner with her, and she did a really wonderful job of explaining the history of her organization and a lot of the legal things she's worked with, and Bob has that available on tape for people to listen to. And Sean Carroll, who's here at UW, and he has been doing a lot of speaking in the last couple of years on molecular and evolutionary biology. And he's quite an entertaining, dynamic person if you get to hear him talk. He could kind of do stand-up comedy, I think. And he makes very tough, difficult scientific things be kind of fun to listen to. Ronald Numbers, who is a Madison historian of science, and John Hott, who's a Georgetown professor of theology and his expertise is on science and religion. So I think I'm going, that's kind of a general overview of what it was and how it's set up. Christina's going to talk a little bit about the two introductory speakers and the Abrahamic religions, which is what she attended in the first discussion. Then I'll mention a little bit about Eugenie Scott, and then I'll talk about Buddhist traditions, which was in the discussion group following that. That's the first day.
Thanks, Kathy. As Kathy mentioned, the conference was structured to allow for a number of all conference presentations and then some breakout sessions. So just a couple of sentences about the first all conference sessions. On the first day, Dr. Dana Geary spoke. She kind of kicked off the conference. What a wonderful presentation to kick off the conference. She is just a wonderful speaker and had some very colorful, wonderful slides about evolution. The title of her presentation was Overview of the Evidence for Evolution. And I think the one thing I want to mention about this, and it's because I'm a big picture thinker, and maybe some of you are too, her presentation was organized into four areas of evidence. The first area is the fossil record. The second area is animal studies and morphology and development. The third area is biogeography and classification. And the fourth area is DNA evidence. So when people speak about evolution, different specialty areas fall into one of those four classifications. And she had a lot of slides and a lot of examples that we don't have time to go into, but I thought you might appreciate those four categories. The next all-conference speaker was Dr. Ronald Numbers. As Kathy mentioned, he is a professor of the history of science and medicine at UW-Madison. So he gave a... he has spoken here at the Humanist Union? Okay. So he gave an overview entitled Anti-Evolutionism from Scientific Creationism to Intelligent Design. So he started about the time of Darwin and what people's thinking was around that time about creationism. And then he progressed up to the present time with the introduction of the intelligent design theory relatively recently out of California. And then that group's alignment with the young earth creationists with the goal of bringing a Christian tradition back to science in the United States. And I'm going to have a little bit more to say about that. That's kind of a... Dr. Numbers might be upset that I boiled down his talk to just those two sentences, but what I really want to spend some time on here is the next session, and it was the first breakout session. I attended, Kathy did not. I think we have some other people here that attended that session, so please feel free to jump in. The session was entitled Abrahamic Religions, Perspectives on Evolution. The intent of this presentation was to have a representative from the three Abrahamic religions, which is therefore to have a Christian, a Jew, and a Muslim, share their perspective on evolution within the context of their religious dogma. I'm sorry to say that the Muslim representative did not show up at the conference. So I'm not sure why. I'm not going to read anything into it, but he wasn't there. So I do have a little printout. Actually, Kathy gave it to me, a little overview of some Muslim thinking that I'll share, but it wasn't presented at the conference at all. There was a wealth of information, though, presented by the Jewish and the Christian representative, so I want to get into a little bit of detail around that. First of all, about the speakers. Dr. Mark Sweatlitz, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, is a historian of science from Chicago. He currently works in the business sector with Deloitte & Touche, who's a consulting firm, but he continues to lecture about Judaism. He has a master's degree in Judaism theology, as well as the PhD of history of science. And he was raised in the Jewish Reform tradition. Now, I didn't know too much about Jewish Reform. Some of you probably know a lot more than I do. But I looked up a one-sentence definition of it, and it's basically a God-centered Judaism that combines respect for Jewish law and Jewish tradition with a progressive Jewish outlook. The Christian speaker was Dr. Jeff Harden, who is a professor of zoology here at UW-Madison. He trained in biophysics in California with a specialty in cell biology and genetics, and he has a master's degree from seminary. I didn't make a note of what seminary school. He teaches zoology and is associated with the religious studies division at UW. I think you'll see right away what's unusual about these two people. They both hold advanced degrees in science and degrees in theology. And that's, I think, a fairly unusual combination. So obviously they were very qualified to talk at this conference. First, the Jewish perspectives on evolution as presented by Dr. Mark Sweatlitz. I'm going to call him Mark because I think I'm not pronouncing his last name right. I hope he doesn't mind. Mark began by giving an overview of the Jewish population in the United States. He said that the two big groupings, of course, are Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews. 80% of the U.S. Jewish population is the non-Orthodox. Theology is just not their primary concern. They're more concerned about public policy and how to live their lives within the context of a secular world. He did highlight four or five realms of thinking. The first one, as articulated by Rabbi Herod Schulweis, is a separation of thinking into facts, which is how things are, versus values, what ought to be. The second viewpoint, as articulated by Rabbi Arthur Green, is in the Kabbalistic tradition. Science and religion complement one another. Science is mechanistic, and religion is about the will and the consciousness. The other three areas are more in the Orthodox Jewish thinking, and he split those into three areas. The majority of Orthodox Jews debate how much to accommodate the secular world and evolution. It's pretty hotly debated in the Orthodox world. He said that there are books and journals galore. And some people get the impression that these books and journals around this debate in the Orthodox world represents mainstream Jewish thinking, but it doesn't. It's a small segment of the Orthodox Jewish population that struggles with these topics. He presented that even among Orthodox Jews, most feel that evolution is consistent with traditional faith, that all is in God's hands. There are two specific factions that he mentions. One are modern Orthodox Jews. They accept the old earth theory and also accept a non-literal interpretation of Genesis and accept evolution from a purely scientific standpoint, even within the Orthodox Jewish tradition. Then there's the ultra-Orthodox. They are primarily young earth and completely reject evolution. He mentioned that represents 4% of the Orthodox Jews, so very small. This country, I believe he was talking about, just this country.
Would that be the Hasidic Jews?
You know, I'm not a Jewish expert, so I'm not sure. I would guess it does, but I don't want to say for sure. Metji, I'm not sure.
If that would be the Hasidic Jews.
Hasidic Jews would fall into that category,
yes.
Maybe? Yeah. So that was basically Mark's presentation. Each person was given 10 minutes to present, and then there was a group discussion. So I'm going to segue into the Christian perspective. Dr. Jeff Harden gave a presentation entitled Evolution and Christian Faith Traditions. He started with a brief statement about God's work and God's Word, the Bible, pointing out several places in Bible verse that point out God as continually sustaining creation and the reliability of natural processes. He showed a slide that was particularly illustrative, I thought, that pulled the different beliefs in Christianity together, and then he provided a number of comments around the slide. And I'm going to hold this up and then I'll pass it around, but I'll try to describe it as well. He represented that there are young earth, there's a continuum of people that feel young earth and then the old earth. Obviously, the young earth thinkers feel that the earth was, 6,000, 4,000 years old, whatever the biblical Genesis literal tradition is. And then you have the literalists from a Bible interpretation down to the non-literal Bible interpretations. Then on the bottom you have mechanistic evolution, which would be probably a rejection of any sort of theistic influence on evolution, a purely science view. And then connecting everything is a line of intelligent design.
There you go.
And it really runs the spectrum. People that believe in intelligent design can be more up towards the young earth literalist view, or down towards maybe a mechanistic view with some sort of a theistic flavor, let's say. So I'll pass this around.
Where does atheism fit on that?
Well, probably down, way down the bottom, off the page, next to mechanistic. You know,
in the flames.
Yeah, in the flames maybe. So a couple more thoughts about that. Young Earth, the belief that all the answers are in Genesis, that the Bible is the supreme authority on how the world was formed, and that you must resist all outside influences of the secular world in your thinking. There's also a faction of Young Earth that accept the fossil record, but they represent the idea that the world just seems old and that new evidence will come into light and overthrow the idea that the fossil record represents an older version of the earth. And then moving down, probably down towards the more mechanistic, down the intelligent design line towards a more mechanistic view, are what are called evolutionary creationists. These scientists are represented by people like Howard Van Til and Francis Collins. They're both important scientists as well as conservative Christians. They believe that evolution is a scientific fact, but they believe in the intelligent design of a God that created the laws of nature that rural evolution. And Dr. Hardin mentioned Francis Collins's book entitled Coming to Peace with Science, that is a fairly popular, written for the popular, you know, public, and has gotten some fairly good reviews. Dr. Hardin then transitioned into a conversation about the problem of metaphysics and the thinking that this brings into people's lives. And he mentions the rather insulting stance that Darwin represents. And we've talked about Darwin at the Humanist Union before. Basically, his interpretation of Dawkins, not Darwin, Dawkins, was that all religious belief is unsophisticated. And you're basically not very intelligent if you believe in any kind of religion. Dr. Hardin really feels that there is a ludicrous overemphasis, those were his words, on evolution as the solution to all biological problems or meanings, and that there are metaphysical questions that bear contemplation. He ended with a story about Jeremy, a college undergrad who struggled with what he was learning in college versus the faith that he had established growing up in a conservative Christian household. Dr. Hardin feels that students are placed in a false dichotomy between their childhood creedal statements and the facts about how the mechanistic world operates. Young people hold these creedal statements without developing any personal faith commitments in their heart and their mind, and then face some crises when they go to college and start learning about broader world perspectives in science. He concluded that regardless of your faith background, everyone should think about what they believe and why. Just a couple of brief notes on the discussion that followed. There seemed to be a consensus by the panelists and general agreement from the audience that knowledge of world religions is very poor in America. People are uninformed, misinformed, and the conclusion was that there should be some sort of mandatory education around world religions that should be part of our school curriculum. Another conclusion that was drawn is that scientific or mechanistic evolution is just not as big of a deal in the Jewish community. Mark thought the likely reason for this is that within the Jewish culture, there is a lot of respect for education and reason as the basis for belief, versus within the fundamentalist Christian tradition where faith is the primary requirement. And then just one final comment on a personal note. I felt there was a really big, maybe this was the session that got closest to what you were talking about, Kathy, about having a dialogue about religion and its and science. I felt like there was a big division in the auditorium. There were some people that were nodding their heads and saying yes when Dr. Hardin was speaking and really clearly aligning with maybe more mechanistic but still intelligent design view as the way they resolved in their hearts and minds their faith, versus I would say the more atheist sort of scientific tradition. I thought Dr. Hardin got some pretty aggressive questions. I thought that were borderline, I don't know, a little bit insulting. But it was a very good presentation and a very good discussion. So it was.
Would you say the hostile questions from the non-religious attendees?
Yeah, I think so. It was more along the lines of how could you possibly blah, 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 blah. You know? And Mary, you were there, I think, so.
Well, I was gratified that the overall tone of the conference by the end of the second day was of mutual respect. And I think people kind of agreed they were disagreeing on certain aspects of it, but there seemed to be general agreement that evolution is important and it needed to be taught and part of our scientific, intellectual culture.
Yeah.
And I think people were careful to avoid insulting one another. Whatever they might have thought.
Yeah, I think there were a couple people that seemed to have
a
mission.
One lady, yes, I remember she was kind of impressive.
Yeah, and one guy too. But I think I agree. In general, I think the conference was very professional, and people had very were open.
People in group, as you said, who were not scientifically trained, so the sessions actually teaching people about what evolution was all about and how it was different from what you might have learned 30, 40, 50 years ago
right.
in school was a very important part of it, the molecular basis.
Right.
And the fossil genes in creatures that no longer have certain properties, but they have non-functional genetic material that's a lesson.
Yeah, that was on the second day. Sean Carroll spoke about fossil genes.
While she was in that session, I had attended one called Life, 3.5 billion years in the Making. And what actually this session was a show and tell. They had two rooms that they had fossils from throughout time that you could look at, that everything was labeled, and just walk around and look at things and discuss it. One thing they did at the beginning is they had several people, they gave out different representations of different life forms. Like they had a piece of coral, and they had something that represented blue-green algae, and they had a bird and a mammal and a tree and a flower. And so he had about 20 people at least that had all these different things, and some had lizards and all, and they had put a timeline, they had just told them to line up in the wall according to how you think things occur. So that was very interesting. It was kind of like interactive. It was kind of like one of those quiz shows. Everybody's audience is telling
them.
Yeah. And then they had everybody just stand in line and how you would think how things had evolved. And then after that, there was a timeline up there, and they had you then stand by where these life forms had occurred during time. So, of course, you had the blue-green algae person down here. Nobody for all the way, like three-quarters of the way across the room, and then you had 20 people jammed up in a ball at the corner, which, of course, was... But so it started out with that. I thought that emphasis was good, but then it just completely broke up, and it was just... remained to be an hour of wandering around and looking at fossils and books and information, which was fun, but not much I could tell you about.
Are you saying they had the human being first?
No. They had the person who was holding a representation of blue-green algae was the first one.
So
and then there were and then there was this huge expanse of time in which very little occurred. And then there was... came in with a few dinosaurs, but even that is just, it just really emphasized how little time a lot of things have evolved and changed. After this discussion group, we had a talk by Eugenie Scott, and Eugenie is, and many of you know it, I didn't plan to spend too much time in Eugenie's talk because Eugenie did meet with some of us in the humanist group, and she did a really nice job of presenting it, and that is available on tape. Let's see her. Sorry. Oh, here we go. And Eugenie is a PhD, former university professor, executive director of the...
National Center for Science.
They just put an acronym in here. And she's been a researcher and an activist in the creation evolution controversy. And what she talked about in this, her title was Evolution, the Science Teacher's Dilemma. And essentially what she did was went through a series of a lot of the changes that took place, certainly with evolution initially being taught, and then creationism, and then intelligent design, and then talked about a lot of the complications and legal aspects of within schools and controversies on what schools can teach and what they can't teach. And one of the things she had talked about in court, within court, is a lemon test, which I thought was interesting. And it's basically, the lemon test determines, is a decision, the decision is it for a religious, is there a religious purpose involved in it? So they actually can look at a case or something being presented and try to determine, is the purpose of this information truly academic, or is the purpose of this information for religious education? And she talked about the religion, the field of religion masquerading as science, and how it was affecting what is being taught. And I think her take-home message was, if you can't rule God in or out scientifically, then you have scientists don't know how X works, therefore X must be because of God. So that's kind of a lot of the overall what's being done with the creationism, intelligent design, saying, well, you know, if anything a scientist can't prove or not sure of, well, then that's their explanation. And did you have anything else?
I think we should move on. Yeah.
That, again, because Eugenie did cover it before, I don't think I'm going to spend more time with her. So the next group that we had, the group I went to was on Buddhist traditions, and the leaders of it were the Venerable George Chernoff. And his name is also Gelong Thubten Saltrin, and he had graduated from MIT with a degree in physics, which was interesting, and had gone to graduate school in physics, and he had taught in school. He then went on to be ordinated as a Tibetan Buddhist monk in Nepal back in 1975, and he's done a lot of work since then, but he does a lot of meditation retreats, and he has been directly involved in receiving teaching from His Holiness Dalai Lama. And then co-presenting with him, and I thought it was difficult placement of two people together. I know that John was there. I don't know if he felt the same way, but the other presenter was a PhD who's executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. And I believe, my impression is he's a Buddhist. Is that what
you...
Yeah,
he's
Buddhist by religion, Buddhist by choice. But he had a lot of very concrete information on the Buddhist religion, more factual, where George was more sitting there, very meditatively, just sitting there, very peaceful in his robes. And there was this very... almost type A personality, really intelligent person saying this, and then they'd go to George and be like, well. So of the information that the two of them gave, a couple points I had were, as George said, you're here, you are now, and believes in reincarnation. So at the point that you're human, you're here and it's now. But, and he had statement, he says, if you have an arrow in your chest, you pull it out rather than question how it got there. So I thought that was an interesting, so it's just a mind versus material. And his statement was, all humans have been animals or will be.
Or will be.
Yeah, the perspective of reincarnation. And he had quoted Dalai Lama as saying, God is your problem, karma is mine. And what is most important is physical, mental happiness. So I pulled out a little bit more information on the Buddhism because that I didn't have from there. And I wanted to point out that 0.5% of people, of adult Americans, view themselves as Buddhist. So it is definitely a smaller group. And I took for some comparisons between, as relative to beliefs not shared, of course there's many, I won't go through those, and they're primarily that there's you know, a God, man, savior, original sin, Garden of Eden, return of a savior, and all of those factors the Buddhists do not believe.
Have a creation story?
No, not Buddhism. The shared belief that they have, what they called, this was an ethic of reciprocity, which is basically saying that Buddhists share a basic rule of behavior that governs how they treat others. And this is based, and some of their quotes would be, a state that is not pleasing, delightful to me, how could I inflict that upon another? Hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. So there are certainly some teachings that are similar. They do not believe in the factor of life after death. Buddhism teaches that humans are trapped in a repetitive cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth. But within that, there isn't any existence of any type of god, gods, or goddesses. And so the other information I pulled out was there was an article called Creation Debate Rather Irrelevant to Buddhism. And that certainly was the take-home message from that group is that, which made it kind of difficult to have an hour discussion on Buddhism and creationism. And they basically said,
it doesn't matter.
We don't care. And and within that, this is by Punadamo Bhikkhu. I probably destroyed this person's name, which is all consonants here. In this is an article out of Toronto, Canada. They were talking about the whole, it says American school districts are debating whether intelligent design should be taught as part of the science curriculum. And they say intelligent design, if you haven't been following this latest skirmish in the culture wars, is creationism all dressed up for polite company. But they're saying the debate doesn't engage, this person who's Buddhist says the debate doesn't engage all religious traditions. For Buddhism, it's pretty much irrelevant. Although Buddhist religion has a rich store of myths and stories, it's not dependent on a specific cosmological narrative. As the Dalai Lama said, on the philosophical level, both Buddhism and modern science share a deep suspicion of any notion of absolutes, whether conceptualized as a transient being, as an eternal, unchanging principle, such as soul, or as a fundamental substratum of reality. Both Buddhism and science prefer to account for the evolution and emergence of the cosmos and life in terms of the complex interrelations of the natural laws of cause and effect. This person closes with, they were saying creationists love to point out flaws in the theory of evolution with a strange assumption that if they can find any problem at all with Darwin, it means Genesis must be literally true. It hardly needs saying this is an absurd non sequitur, but absurd or not, it has the unfortunate effect of shaping and hardening the debate about human origins for decades. The possibility that there may be other options or even nuances barely gets a hearing, and that's reflecting on that certainly Buddhism doesn't really play into the discussions. And this is just, I'm interested in this, this is creation of Judaism and Christianity, which is certainly longer. Then they talked about Islam, Hinduism, and at the end it says creation in Buddhism. And in one sense it says practically all versions of Buddhism do not recognize any creator. That's the whole statement. That brings us to the end of the first day. And do you want to say the Sean Carroll? Were you going to hint that?
Oh yeah, sure.
Pardon? What?
You got 6 more days.
End of the first day.
No.
five.
That shows you I didn't even get it.
Yeah, we can't go through tons of details on the next couple presentations, but I will hand around. Sean Carroll did an excellent presentation. He's a very good speaker, as Kathy mentioned. He had some really funny video clips, in particular a video cartoon of a guy who had gone around England interviewing people on what they thought about evolution. And this guy had put these into cartoons and animated them, and it was just hilarious.
They were all
and
animals.
They were all animals.
Jellyfish or something, too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm perfectly satisfied with the way I am.
But Sean, yeah, it's like, I don't think we could evolve any farther, could we? You know, just conversations like that.
You can find it on iTube.
Yeah, on YouTube. So I will pass this around, this article about Sean Carroll. We don't have a lot of time to talk about his particular presentation, but... an interesting article about him. Do you want me to say a few words about John Haught?
Steve Paulson.
Yeah.
Sean usually presents every year at the Darwin Day event in UW-Madison, and it's open to the public. I think it's the first weekend in February, so by all means.
Quite a few of us saw his presentation last time, but he definitely is fun to listen to.
Yeah. The next presentation was entitled Evolution and Faith, Can They Be Reconciled? And it was very interesting. It was by John Haught. He was interviewed by Steve Paulson. John Haught is, I believe, a theologian from Georgetown University. Just to highlight a couple things from his talk, he had a visual of the timeline of development on Earth, similar to what you were talking about, Kathy, with the fossils. And he had I don't know how many volumes, 30 volume set. So picture a 30 volume set of books. And on page one is the Big Bang. Well, humans come into the picture on the very last page of the very last volume in the last 1/10 of the page. Which, and he quoted Bertrand Russell as saying, if the point is the development of intelligence, why did it take so long to produce so little? So that was kind of amusing. His whole approach, though, was that this reductionism that we find in science these days, that's fine. Science needs to go forward with their view of the world, but it doesn't explain everything. It doesn't give meaning to everyone's life. There is more to life than a reductionist view of the world. He argued for a wider perspective of experiencing life that moves beyond pure science. Things like, what about your interpersonal relationships? What about the theory that every mental event we experience is just as much a part of nature as physical events? So he was very thoughtful and intelligent and interesting to listen to, and I think people had some good discussions around that. And I don't know, Mary or John or anyone else that was there have anything more to add about? You missed that. Yeah.
The
yeah.
He's really alive and turned on.
Yeah.
Steve Paulson, who was a very interesting person to do that, as many of you know, is a long-term public radio person. And he did in the discussion, he did a science versus religion, what's really at stake in this debate. And this was in the next discussion group, where he basically had interviewed over time through his programs many of the leading people or people with leading thoughts in evolution, intelligent design, creationism. And one of the questions he seemed to always ask people after these long periods of discussion was, well, are you absolutely sure, without question, that there really isn't any other influence? Call it what you want, any other power, influence, someone or something else that comes along and touches things. And interestingly, even though the people he interviewed were many of the leading authors for the current literature against creationism, against intelligent design, in favor of evolution, none of them really would come right out and say, absolutely, without question, I know that there is absolutely no other influence beyond genes evolving.
That's thinking like a scientist, is it not?
Well, it was interesting, but and I think that was his take-home message, is that along with this theory of being gentle with other people's points of views, there really isn't anybody who's absolutely 100% sure that they know and have the answer. Even the ones that are publishing that they're sure and have the answer. But he really pinned them down and said, you know, they all said, well, you don't know while you're still alive. Who knows? So I thought that was a little bit more open to some of the opinions of the people that were there that were obviously people who were in favor of creationism, intelligent design. And she's going to do the closing remarks.
I'm going to combine the breakout session that I went to when Kathy was at, the one she just spoke about, with the last presentation. We've already mentioned Jay Hughes, who is the Buddhist. I think he kind of represented the modern American Buddhist perspective at the Buddhist traditions. He's a really interesting guy. He's an executive director of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies out on the East Coast. And he presented a breakout session called Manimals, Cyborgs, and Gattaca, the Biopolitics of Human Enhancement Technologies. And then closed the whole conference with a similar sort of talk. And to me, this was more the traditional area that you'd expect from bioethics. He got into talking about human advancement.
Yeah.
Where do we go from here? That's really what he was trying to address. He talked about psychopharmacology, genetic engineering, and nanotechnology and artificial intelligence are all converging. And that's going to allow us to increase the progress of human advancement and open new possibilities in the modern world. And he's got some things that I'll mention in a minute that he thinks are the next steps. But his conclusion was really about 50 years from now, we are going to have to make some big decisions on bioethics, because the technologies will have advanced to the point where things beyond your wildest imaginations might be happening. What will happen? We might be able to cure disabilities. We will be increasing longevity. Perhaps, and I think this is the Buddhist part of them, possibly understand and enhance emotional experiences. Like religious phenomenon and the way the brain experiences the world. It brings up many ethical questions, like who is a citizen with a right to life? He mentioned that Spain is considering ape rights, the great apes being very intelligent creatures. Who controls reproduction options? Should disabilities be fixed? Is it moral to extend people's lives? What should be the limit, if any, on brain control, such as Prozac, Ritalin, kind of the psychopharmacology question? And he represented two extreme views. On one side is what he called bioconservatism. These are people that include several very different sort of groups that you wouldn't think ever would have an alignment, but they fall into this bioconservative sort of bucket. One is the religious right, which he called the 900-pound gorilla in the debate. But the other one is what he called the deep ecologists. These are people that kind of align along Aldous Huxley with his Brave New World and what horrible things we could get ourselves into if we lose our humanity. Then a third group he labeled pro-disability extremists, people who feel like disabilities should not be cured, that there's some uniqueness in every individual human being and that's the way it should stay. He said that there are many people who feel like there are sacred taboos, that there are social mores that underpin our society that should be preserved and not tinkered with. And lastly, the bioconservative view feels like the risks are just unknowable, so you should not even go there. Then he represented what his group is supporting moving forward, which is a transhumanist perspective. He kind of categorized it as an intellectual and cultural movement that argues for reason and science to drive human improvement. He thought it was really the legacy of the Enlightenment, and represented by Julian Huxley, who felt like the human species can transcend itself. They think more along the lines of personhood, and who is a thinking being, and who is self-aware. They fall more on the side of individual liberty and progress, and transhumanists feel like the risks are manageable. For the next immediate steps, he felt that we should accelerate the progress of using transgenic chimeric animals for experimentation, move away from using great apes. So that would be like I'm taking pigs and cloning human DNA into pigs and doing drug testing on animals of that nature. Now, you know, I struggle with this because it gets into, well, are pigs so lowly that you can just do anything you want with pigs? I mean, where do you draw the line, I guess? But he was representing that as one possible way that science could go to get away from some less ethically palatable research.
That's not
ethically palatable for a lot of people, but he felt like that was one thing that we should be looking at. Taking human DNA, cloning it into lesser animals, and doing drug experimentation with that.
But there are times that you can do the same thing on a computer without hurting animals.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because his next point...
What foresight!
Yeah. Was computation biological methods, which he called in silico experimentation, where really computing is coming along leaps and bounds, and you can do a lot of computer and mathematical modeling that will eliminate some of the need to do experimentation on living creatures, and that should be progressed.
Certainly 50 years from now it'll be happening.
And then I just wanted to mention a couple other things. I have his entire presentation, all the slides if you'd like to take a look at it. It was very entertaining. But he said, okay, what could stop our evolution? So he had four categories of things that we really do not want to see happen. The first category he called the bangs. That could be, he had a little icon of a dinosaur that said, never forget. So these are things like, we got hit by an asteroid, a super volcano comes and ruins the world. Nuclear war, yeah. The other category was crunches. That's a permanent civilizational stasis, as maybe embodied by the Road Warrior in Mad Max. We kind of get stuck and can't move beyond it. Shrieks is a rapid, undesirable post-human takeover, a la the Terminator, where we maybe evolve some aspect of genetic engineering or computational biology that some place in there is the seed of our own destruction that we can't foresee. And then there were the whimpers. Evolution to an undesirable post-human state may be similar to the Borg. So his conclusion was, I think, kind of weak. He thought our future could be really cool. Our future could be really awful. And you have to decide for yourself where you stand on some of these bioethical issues, because they're coming. And they'll be more a part of our public policy making. So that's Jay Hughes. And I just want to say thank you very much, Jay Hughes. He, of all the people that I talked to, I had sent out emails requesting for them to send me their slide deck. And Jay Hughes sent it right, the whole thing, right to me. And that was very, very nice of him, so I appreciate that.
You mentioned making sure that all the babies survive, but he didn't say anything about overpopulation?
That was one ethical aspect of what he mentioned. Is it ethical to... he mentioned that more around longevity, but you could bring it up in many different contexts. What is our ethics towards human population and, you know, where we need to go? That's a big problem.
I think one other thing that was, I believe, in my notes it's at the end of his talk, but it was one of the things is that looking ahead is that it's highly likely that we will lose natural diversity. And we may gain diversity, but it will be intentional, an intentional gain of diversity. As she mentioned, there would be, you know, less disabled people and changes on factors of aging. But overall, there could be a loss of individuality because there's going to be a real blurring of boundaries as all of these techniques in artificial intelligence and all these other factors, that we could be lose individuality and lose diversity. And I thought that the whimpers, shrieks, crunches, and bangs was pretty scary, that part we went through. It didn't make it seem real positive for those of us who have younger children to think of some of the possibilities. If we tinker too much, things couldn't work out.
Then the question is, are we back to creationism? Or is it evolution?
Well, yeah.
Just simply stupidity.
No, it's a good question. I mean, yeah. If we're masterminding the tinkering, how does that play in with evolution and?
I think the problem with Hugh's presentation is that it takes evolution in a very, very simplistic sense, in that there is some conscious or unconscious sequence of the phylogenetic optimality following a particular course. In reality, the human organism is a kind of loose coalitional structure where evolution is occurring simultaneously in lots of different directions. So there is no single teleology in which evolution is heading. It's just a false presentation of what is really going on with human evolution.
That's sort of our bias, that it's a forward progress.
Yeah. Right? I mean, humans are losing color vision now. At the same time, they're developing increased immunological responses to because of our overcrowding. So there's lots of dynamics going on in all kinds of different ways in the human organism.
Yeah. And they'll be selected to survive the insurance company. But venom to that evolution in humans happens within groups. There are thousands and thousands of groups of people that have their own trajectory in evolution. And of course, they're all interacting with each other, and this is permanent over millions of years.
Yeah, unfortunately, the gene pool is worldwide, so you don't have what's called a genetic isolation anymore. So you can, you probably have no idea what ethnic or racial characteristics are in your genes or anyone else's. And
good example on a TV program log, you probably saw it a year or so ago. They were tracing three different programs, I think, and they were finally traced the background of some of the reporters, two of whom were black, and they were used DNA data to try to find out what tribes and what part of Africa they came from. It turned out that their DNA was mostly European.
Yeah. But a lot of these ethical questions aren't going to be decided by the United States. I mean, this is a worldwide issue. There are scientists out in South Korea. There are scientists all over the place. Some of them worried about ethical issues and some of them not. Pursuing human cloning, a whole number of things. So these issues really are upon us right now.
Also with genetic engineering and crop plants.
Right.
Huge amount of moving genes around from frequently like the mountains. Various
Yep.
So, there was some mention of the absent biosome, and one of you did some research about what he might have said and why you might mention what you found out.
About who?
The Islam.
Muslim. Oh.
The guy that didn't show up.
He was the physician, right?
Yeah.
I know he was. I think he's a physician, and I think it might have been something, related. His inability to come was related. I think it might have been a job-related thing.
Yeah, I have a printout Where did you take it back? The Muslim perspectives on evolution. Basically, I'll just work from memory here while I'm shuffling my papers. They have some very similar sort of dilemmas as Christian thinkers do, as far as the dichotomy between their religious dogma and the science and evidence of evolution. So really, Muslims and Christians are very much in the same boat as far as trying to come to terms with how they fit evolution into their thinking. So as far as an alignment with some religious friends, that seems to be where a lot of Christians are, with Muslims, and trying to sort that out.
And with Hinduism, it's Brahma, but it's, again, a similar approach of creationism.
I did say that there's more interpretation within the Islamic area on this young earth theory, that it says that the earth was created in 6 days, but to Allah, days are like thousands of years. And so I think there's a little bit more leeway in some of their interpretation of how that
that's
happened.
The way some of the Jews
use. Right.
Rational.
Right.
And I heard that in Christian churches in the 1950s.
Right. Well, yeah, it's within Christian thinking too, that one day is metaphorical.
There are plenty of older creationists out there. They're shouted down by organizations like Answers in Genesis and ICR. And what's really interesting is when they take these polls and ask, I mean, and from what I've seen, I worked at the National Center for Science and Debate with Eugenie, and one of the things that we tended to think was when they do these polls and ask them, you know, do you think humans were created as they are now, like it says in the Bible, 10,000 years ago, a lot of people who've never really given that any thought and probably don't have a committed position will say, oh yeah, okay, I'll go with the Bible, because they've been raised to think that the Bible is this good book.
Yeah.
You know, so the figure that 60% of the American public are young earth creationists, we came to think, not as any formal position, but when we talked about it over lunch, we'd say, yeah, that's probably conflated by a good 25%.
Yeah. Eugenie Scott mentioned a similar poll, and the question was, it was a true or false question. Humans evolved from earlier forms of animals, true or false? And they ranked the countries based on, at the top, people that said false, who would believe in evolution. That was Ireland, Denmark, Sweden, kind of down that way. And then from the bottom, the most people said false, meaning humans were created in their present form. Turkey was at the bottom, and then the United States.
Yeah, I read a conservative perspective on that same poll, and they simply branded all the countries at the top that accepted evolution as socialist.
Thank our speakers very much.